just turned that off by accident. Let's try that again. Okay. Someone tell me if the camera is blinking. Thank you. Okay. We are, God willing, going to wrap up EO's conclusion of round one today. Because we have to. Because this is the last class before Pesach. So I don't want to have to go what amounts to 3 weeks, since we're skipping to Tuesdays, and come back to this speech.
When are we coming back?
The Tuesday after Pesach. So whatever that date is, I believe it's the 14th of April. And welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're in we're towards the end of the second chapter of this three-chapter speech. It began in Perek Yud-Bet, chapter 12, when Job turns to his visitors and says, "You are not enlightening me, you are only mocking me, you speak as though I were a fool. You talk about how there is hope and how, you know, there is justice and the wicked are at peace instead. I agree with you that God is the mightiest, but to me that means that God is the source of all destruction. He brings down the mighty." By the way, something I only noticed by accident this week. I was looking for something completely different, and that's how you discover the best things. But if you take a fast look at chapter 12, sentence 21, someone had asked me for a verse for a headstone, and they wanted to talk about someone being generous. And so I was looking at different verses that involve generosity, and lo and behold, if you see, you see Job chapter 12 sentence 21. It's if you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1636. The Hebrew is particularly beneficial, but the truth is, you'll see it in the English as well. It goes shofech buz al nedivim. It's in that passage where he talks about God casting scorn upon the great, as part of the general reversals, where God brings down the mighty, shames those who have been powerful. Well, take a look now, please, at Psalms, Tehillim, chapter 107, sentence 40. And again, if you're in the Stone Tanakh, what you want is page 1533. And lo and behold, the beginning of the sentence. Chapter 107, verse 40. I did reference it at the top of your sheets for this week. It's source 1 on the sheet, so you can see the verse number there. It's the same exact beginning. Shofech buz al nedivim, that he casts scorn upon the nediv is usually a prince or somebody of power. It's this opposition once again, which I have to credit Ellen for asking about one of the early weeks, the opposition between Job and Psalms, in which they'll use the same exact words but mean entirely different things. In Psalms, it's talking about how God heaps scorn upon princes who are unworthy, and it's praising God for it, thanking God for not simply honoring the powerful, but instead calling them to account. Whereas in Job, it's God destroys people. He tears down those who are in power. It's a sign of how awful God is, and awful not in the awe sense, in the awful sense. It's same exact words, with entirely different intent. So I thought that was really interesting. But after he concludes that section in chapter 13, he says, God is going to punish you for misrepresenting him. You are the ones who lack faith. What you say about God is wrong. And that brought us to what we saw last week, where he said, I am going to speak the truth regarding God. And we had that incredible line in which he said, though he will kill me, I will still long for him. And we gave different explanations for how to read that line. And then he turns to address God for the trial and set up his case. And he said, there are two rules. The rules for this trial are that you not strike me and that you not intimidate me. And if you, God, will maintain those two conditions, then I am going to address you. And we saw his parody of God's hester panim, God hiding his face. He says, God, if you'll be good, then I will not hide my face. And when you call me, I will respond. It's a turnabout on God. We saw that. That was in chapter 13, sentences 20 to 22. And then he began to make his claims. He has three claims to God. The first claim we saw is his claim, I am no sinner. That was chapter 13, sentence 23-24. His second claim was, after that, I am insignificant, and therefore I am unworthy of the attention you pay to my sins. You shackle me, you limit my movement, the emphasis we mentioned on movement in particular, I can't get away from God. And that brings us to his third of the three claims against God in this trial. So we are up to chapter 13, sentence 28. If you are using the stone at Tanakh, you want the very top of page 1639. Job says, having already described himself as someone who is insignificant, he says, in addition to being insignificant, man is temporary. V'hu kirakav yivleh. Kiveged achalo ush. Yivle, balui, right, is something that wears out, right, something that deteriorates. Vehu kirakav yivle, man wears out like rakav. Rakav is something that decays. Kiveged achalo ush, like a garment eaten by a moth. He says, man is here only temporarily. He decays and deteriorates. And then he builds on that. He says, chapter 14, sentence 1. Adam yulud isha, ketsar yamim usvaroges. Man is born from woman. He is of short days and filled with roges. Roges being one of his magic words. We've used quite a bit. He's gone back to his first speech, which he concluded by saying, Vayavo roges, that roges has befallen him. We've translated it as turmoil. That's the best translation I've seen so far. But he says, human beings are temporary. We have short lives. We're filled with turmoil. What do you think he means when he says, born of woman? What is that meant to connote?
Mortal.
Mortal. Why? Well, he's not speaking of himself in terms of strength. Maybe true, but it's not what he means.
He's not an angel, he's a human.
He's a human being, so this is a way to define himself as human? Could be. Take a look, please, at source number 2. For those who came in after we started, you must take a look at number 1 at some point. But take a look at source number 2. He says, what does it mean to be Yilud Isha? Shu pachot vigarua mitzad shnei kitzot or kitzvot chayav. That man is lesser and inferior in the two ends of his life. Ki mitzad katzeyu arishon hu Yilud Isha nolad mitipat tmeya. He says, in the beginning of man's life, unlike what one might imagine for some angel, celestial being, man is born from a woman, born from an impure drop, and there, I, in the interest of space, took out some of his text, but he goes on to describe the very mundanity and physicality of being born inside of another body and emerging from a body. And he says, "Mitzad ketzayu ha'acharon hu ketzar yamim." And as far as the end of his life, he has short days. So the way Malbim understands it is that the idea of being born of woman is a term for the mundane physicality of a person's origins, and in fact it's almost, you know, rendered as a euphemism. You know, trying to capture what he believes is man's lower nature, but do it in a way that sounds nice by saying born of woman as a shorthand for what it connotes. Yeah?
Maybe it's the opposite. Maybe he was reminding God that people were not supposed to be born of woman, but after the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, they are necessarily born of women, and this recalls to God the humble beginnings.
Why would you suggest that? Why would you suggest that we were not supposed to be born of women before being kicked out of the garden?
Because God created Adam and Hava.
Yeah.
And
And what? As far as I recall, he commanded them to procreate before they ever ate from the fruit. That was in the plan from the beginning. We have to be really careful of what George Bernard Shaw said regarding Paradise Lost, that every good Christian now believes that every word in Paradise Lost is found in the Bible. The ideas of original sin and linking eating from the fruit with procreation and so on, it's not ours. We were meant to be born of woman from the very beginning. That's part of the design.
This sounds very Christian to me, this point of view. You know, man is born a humble thing. He struggles to get out of the muck, and the only good thing that happens is he goes to heaven. That's so Christian.
Well, the going to heaven part I haven't seen here at all.
No, but after, if he struggles enough to get it. There was once at a Christian funeral where they talked about the bad things that had happened in that person's life. I mean, I've never...
They're free to.
I've never been in a...
I think we actually said at the end of the last class, they got most of their ideas from us in one form or another.
Well, yeah, we know.
And the idea that a human being is born mundane and destined to sin is not the same thing as original sin. They're two different ideas. Thanks, you. They're two different ideas. But we do have this belief, and that's what he's expressing here. Mind you, Job doesn't always reflect what Jews are supposed to believe, what Judaism says. But in this case, what he's saying here, the idea that we are physical and mundane, and that brings with it an inherent weakness and a finite state, isn't news to Jewish belief. And I wouldn't view it as under the Christian copyright.
Susan. It says here
that
that Akavya, the son of Mahalalel.
Akavya ben Mahalalel, yes.
Okay, and said, reflect upon three things, and
right.
Thou will come within the power of sin. Know whence thou camest, and whither thou art going,
yeah.
And before whom thou wilt in the future have to account. That's like account and reckoning. Whence thou camest from a purified
putrefied.
Yeah, sorry,
or putrid, that should be.
But he's referring to being facing God after.
Yeah, that. Right. Because that's Pirkei Avot. That's the third chapter of Pirkei Avot that they're quoting. But it's definitely not where Job is.
Okay.
It's two entirely different.
Okay, that's not a good definition.
No, and he's bringing an associated comment because of the idea of being born from this. That's all. But it is a different point. So what Job is saying here, in addition to his first two claims, is he's saying, I'm temporary, flawed from the beginning, limited at the end, and then he continues to say, Pasuk Bet, sentence 2, Kitzitz Yatsa Vayimal. He comes forth like a flower, like a blossom. Vayimal, and then he is cut off. Vayivrach, he flees Katzel, like shade, Velo Ya'amod, and he does not endure. Inferior in the beginning and inferior at the end. And I would call your attention to the two verbs he used here first. He has others, but two particularly, Yatsa and Yivrach. Remember we said last time, Job's goal is to get away from God. He wants to flee, and he can't. And here he talks about Yatsa by Yivrach, wanting to flee, wanting to get away, and being incapable. Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. He turns to God and he says, Aval zeh pakakta einecha. On a creature like this, you open your eyes? Really? A creature like this? And you notice the term he uses for this, right? Zeh. In English, as we try to teach our children, when you speak of an object, you say what? When you speak of a person, you say who? Right? That's what we try to say, that's English. So, in Hebrew, when you say zeh normally is not a reference to a person. Zeh is a reference to an object. He's describing himself as an object. Aval zeh pakachta einecha. Even for something like this, you're going to pay attention, God. V'OC, and I, here he's talking about himself as a person, once he has OC, that's a human thing. Taviv mishpati mach. You're going to bring me to judgment with you. I don't belong there, meaning I belong in my trial of you, God. I don't belong in your trial of me. That's the problem. I am not worthy of being judged in this way. In Pasuk Dalet, he says, Mi tein tahor mitamei, lo echad, which you can translate in a few different ways, but the simple read is, Mi yitein tahor mitamei. Nobody gets to go from being tamei to tahor in your eyes, God. Tamei being impure, tahor being pure. No one gets to cleanse himself, God, in your eyes. Lo echad. Not even one. Nobody. Dat Mikra notes there's a change in meter here. The previous sentences all had this same sort of pacing to them of the two halves, and each one had a decent number of syllables. But here, mi yitein tahor mitamei lo echad is like a sigh. It's like an exhalation. After he has expressed his three claims against God, and he has said, I'm not worthy, I have a short life, he says, God, come on. Nobody actually is ever going to be found innocent in your court. Now here, Rashi and Ibn Ezra take an interesting tack. Take a look at source number 3. They say that Job is claiming that he is indeed born in sin. You didn't like that idea before. Now you really don't like it. Job is saying he is born in sin. Take a look. And he quotes you a verse from our favorite mirror image of Job, Tehillim, from Psalms. Inyano k'inyan hein ba'avon cholalti. It's like Psalms 51:7, in which King David says, I was conceived, cholalti, I was conceived in sin. Ki ha'adam nivra midavar tamei. Because a human being is created from something impure, from impure material. Now, again, it's not the same as the Christian idea, because the difference is that within the Christian idea, it's actually a result of sin, and it's a sinful act that creates the person. We are not looking at it that way. But what he's saying is that I am mundane, and I am flawed, I am created out of matter, I'm never going to be perfect in my service of God. That's just not who I'm capable of being. And that, to my mind, might explain something from the very beginning of the book. You remember how, when his kids would throw their parties, he would bring karbonot, he'd bring offerings, and we said at the time, he knows of nothing they've done wrong. The most he can say is, maybe they thought something wrong in their hearts, but this is an insight into Job's psyche. They're human beings, they must have sinned. It can't be otherwise. By their very nature, they are sinful, and so he is going to bring offerings on their behalf without being able to point to anything at all. The report card is clean. Nonetheless, they're human beings. They're born in sin. They must have sinned. And that's what's driving him when he brings these offerings. And so he says, Im charutzim yamav, mispar chadashav itach, chukav asisa velo ya'avor. He says, if his days are charutzim, charutzim here at that mikra renders it means decreed. If man's days are decreed, the number of his months is already set by you, God. Chukav asisa, you have set his chok, you have set his boundary. Velo ya'avor, and it's never going to change. The phrase in Hebrew, chok velo ya'avor. That's the boundary, and you're never crossing it. So he says to God, concluding this section, She'ei me'alav v'yechdal. So God, do me a favor, turn away from him, just let him be, let man be. Ad yirtze kisachir yomo. Until he completes his day like a laborer. And we've seen the laborer image earlier in this book as well. He says, enough already. Let it go. Stop punishing human beings. Stop zapping me for whatever tiny thing you think I did, or whatever insignificant flaw you found. It's enough. Let man live out his life and be done. That's the conclusion of this segment, and then he's going to shift gears into a metaphor. But there's something very interesting that he did here in sentence 6. The opening verb, she'ei. Does that sound familiar? Well, that's an interesting one. She'ei Shabbat b'nei ami. Okay, which would apply, turn to, or listen to. Where else? It does, but... And it probably has something to do with that on some level, and I don't know how. But no, the very first use of this verb in the Torah. Very important rule, in case I haven't mentioned it. I thought I mentioned it at some point some year. But Ibn Ezra writes in his introduction to the Chumash that if you ever want to know the true meaning of a word, look at the first time it appears in the Chumash. And that gives you insight into what it's really about. Well, the first time this word appears is with Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel. Exactly. When Cain brings his offering, Cain brings the offering, and then Hevel brings his offering, it says that God turns to Hevel's offering, but not to Cain's, and he uses the same word. Vayisha Hashem el Hevel vel minchato, vel Cain vel minchato lo sha'a. He turned to Abel's offering, he didn't turn to Abel himself, he did not turn towards Cain and his offering. Now, what that means is we're setting Job up very interestingly. Because when God doesn't turn to Cain, he is murderously angry. Job says, you know, God, turn away. I'd actually be happier that way. Where Cain sees God turning towards somebody as benevolent and, you know, and parental and positive, Job sees it as just the source of pain. When God turns towards somebody, they're going to suffer. That's the way he looks at it. It's his complete reversal from the beginning. And maybe you can combine that with the whole Tahor Mi Tameh and Yilud Isha and maybe, you know, do something broader with the section. But that's the idea here. His third charge, piled onto his first two, is, God, I'm temporary and I'm lowly, and therefore you should stop zapping me, and along with me, all the rest of the human beings out there. He's bringing a class action. One other note on this, that I saw in Mitzudat David. Remember that Sofar, the third of the friends, visitors, whatever, his claim was that there is justice and you don't realize how you've sinned. Because sometimes it isn't that you sinned actively, it's that you didn't fulfill your potential. You could have been so much better. And therefore God's going to punish you because you weren't so much better. So Mitzudat David says that's what Job is responding to here. Take a look, please, at source number 4 on your sheets. Af al zeh, even on this one, God, you're going to pay attention. He says, Af al briyash fala kazeh, even on a lowly creature like this, human being. Pakachta einecha, you have opened your eyes, lashgiach b'ma'asav uludakdeka acharav, to go see what he's doing and to investigate him. V'yoser mizeh, shegam osi, sh'animin u'kamei avon, tavim chavim mishpalo ansheni, and even me, not just everybody else, but me, I'm actually innocent of sin, and you're judging me, and you're going to punish me. For what? Because I wasn't as wise as I could have become. Based on my potential, I could have been better. Kasher Mart Sofar had said. And he responds to it and says, he says, what are you looking for from me? You can't expect us to be perfect. The idea that somebody who's born from the impure is going to be so pure that he's going to continually expand his heart with wisdom, even demanding that I fulfill my potential, is also unfair. That's his statement. It's too much to ask. And so he turns to God and lays out these charges. It's really a fascinating read, this section. When I thought that we were going to get through this point last class, so I tacked on source number 5 as a way to just end it on a little bit of an upbeat note, because what a terrible, I mean, it's beautiful but frightening at the same time and depressing throughout. But if you take a look at number 5, Midrash on that verse in which he says, who could, as we rendered it, who could become tahor when he has been tameh? Who could become pure when he has been impure? But the Midrash reads it differently. Mi tain tahor mi tameh, lo echad, and it capitalizes echad. not one, but the one. And what he's saying is, who can produce impure from pure? Is that not what God can do? Watch the way the Medrash reads it. Kigon, Avraham b'Terach, right? Abraham is born from Terach, the idolater. Chizkiah, the righteous king Chizkiah, is born from Ahaz, who was a king who tried to drive people towards idolatry. Yoshiahu, Me'amon, King Yoshiahu, another one, who is righteous, born from a terrible king, King Amon. Mordechai, Mishim'i, Mordechai from the Purim story is born from Shim'i, unclear what Shim'i's sin is that he gets to be in this. Yisrael, Me'ovdei Kochavim, the Jews, Israel, are produced from idolaters, right? As we'll say in the Haggadah, that originally our ancestors were idolatrous. Ha'olam haba me'olam hazeh, the next world is born out of this one. Mi'asa Kain, who did this? Mi'tziva Kain, who has commanded this? Mi'gazar Kain, who decreed this should be? Lo yechido shel olam, isn't it the one, capital O, of the universe? God can produce the tahor from the tameh. I thought it was a really nice, positive read, and if we were stopping here, then we would say, okay, now I can go into Pesach happily. But that's not where we are. We are moving into the next segment here. And the next segment is really from sentence 7 to the end of the chapter, in which Job seems to say there is no hope of resurrection, and there's no hope, therefore, at all. Yeah. You got it. That's what he seems to say here. This is the ultimate response to Eliphaz in particular. Remember that the first of his visitors, Eliphaz, chapter 7, I think, he had said... No, I'm sorry, chapter 6. Job responds then after that. Anyway, he had said, you just need a narrative of hope. You need to recognize that things like this happen in people's lives, they go through terrible situations, and then things get better. That was what Eliphaz had wanted to say to him. Just turn to God, and then there will be a next step. There will be a next day. And Job says to him, I'm sorry, there is no happy ending. There is no hope. It all ends in death. And there is no joy. And he brings what I think of as the parable of the tree, sentences 7 to 12. He says, Ki yeshla eitz tikva. And that's again a magic word we've seen over and over again. The word tikva for hope is a loaded word that keeps on repeating through the book. He says, Ki yeshla eitz tikva, trees have hope. Im yikares va'od yachalif. If it's cut down, it's still going to produce growth, right? New plants can grow out of the trunk. It's an interesting word to use when he uses yachlif, because he's used yachlif before to refer to death. But here it means to change, to metamorphose, the idea that something new is going to come out. V'yonakto lo sechdal. And its shoots, that which comes out of it, will not end. Im yazkin ba'aretz sharsho, even if its root will age in the ground, ube'afar yamus gizo, and in the dust its stem will die, me'reach mayim yafriach, from the scent of water it will flower, ve'asa katzir kamonata, and it will produce branches just like a sapling. The plants can regrow. Age doesn't stop it. It's interesting. In sentence 7, he talked about being cut off, an act of violence. And he says it will survive the violence. And in sentence 8 and 9, he says not only that, age doesn't stop it either. When water comes, it is restored. And this is, of course, botanical fact for many, many species of trees and plants, that when a time of drought, they simply stop growing. They go dormant. And when water shows up again, they continue to grow. Think about our grass, right? That's the way grass functions. So what he's saying is, trees have it good. You know, there, they have hope. Whatever happens, there can always be a next stage. Dov Mikra notes also that he has used deliberately the language of the grave. Right? Like in sentence 8, he says, it ages ba'aretz, in the ground. Right? Or Baaretz Shorsho. And Be'afar Yamud Gizo, in the dust, is where it dies. So he's saying the tree inhabits the grave, but it gets to come out of the grave. Whereas in Pasuk Yud, sentence 10, V'gever Yamus V'yechalash, he says, a human being doesn't get that. Men age Yechelash could be rendered in two different ways, either to become weak or to be cut off. I've seen both. Vayigva Adam v'ayo, man expires, and then where is he? He's gone. Azlu mayim miniyam, the water is gone from the sea, which is the source for the river. V'nahar yechrav v'yavesh, and the river will then dry up. V'ish shachav v'lo yakum, a man lies down, does not get up. Ad bilti shamayim lo yakitsu. He says, long as there's a heaven, until the heavens themselves cease, he's not waking up, he's not going to be awoken from his sleep. Very strong, no? Interestingly, I should have noted really on your sheet, if you were to look at Daniel Yud Bet, the last verse in the book of Daniel, right, some of you were here when we did it, you will see the opposite. He says, Rabim mi shenei afar yakitsu, the many of those who slept in the dust will wake up, using the same language as is used here in the negative, Daniel uses in the positive. But he says there's no hope, there's nothing. Rita, you were going
to
say?
I just want to say, last week he was talking about that he has faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's a little confusion here. He's going back and forth.
Well, the question is, what was that faith, right? We had different ways to explain his expression of faith then. One way to express it was, indeed, I have hope that there's going to be rejuvenation. And then the other way to take it was, no, I don't have any hope that God's going to do anything for me. He's going to kill me and that's it. Nonetheless, God wants honesty out of me and that's what I'm going to do. You know, it depends on how you read it, but you're right. If you read that sentence there as expressing a belief that God will do something, then what you're left with is a rather different perspective here. So, first of all, what I think he's doing here, really, is fundamentally a response to Bildad. What, in chapter 8, what was Bildad's major message? What was Bildad's major theme out of the three visitors? Right? Bildad's theme was that destruction can actually have a positive end. Bad things can happen, but turn out to be good. And his image that he used was the tree. Right? It's uprooted from here, but then it's planted somewhere else, and it grows, and it's better than it ever was before. But here it had stones, and there it has space, whatever. So he says, yeah, that's really good if you're a tree. But it doesn't work that way for human beings. This is him responding to Bildad and saying there's a limit to your metaphor. That's the idea. And he says, and I'm rushing a little bit because I really want to make sure we finish this chapter today. But he says, I wish it were true. I wish human beings actually had hope of a resurrection. He says, if you read sentences 13 to 17, Pasuk Yud Gimel, he says, Mi Yitain. Mi yitain is an expression we've seen before. It's, I wish, would that this were so. Mi yitain b'sh'ol tatspineni. I wish that he would hide me in sh'ol, the term that we use for the grave. Tatspineni, like, since Pesach is coming next week, right? Safun. Safun, right? When you have that which is hidden, and then it is taken out. So he says, I wish, b'sh'ol tatspineni. Now I'm going to give you all nightmares at your Seder. Tastireni hatshuv apecha. I wish that you would hide me until your anger was gone. Tashis lichok. This is kareni. You would set a boundary for me. He used the word chok in the negative before as the termination of someone's life. Now he's saying, I wish that you would set an end, and then you would remember me. Then bring me back. Im yamus gever. He says, if a person dies, hayichyeh, will he come back to life? Kol yimei tzava'i ayachel. Then all the days of my labor on this earth, we've used the word tzava ale eretz before to refer to labor. All the days of my labor, ayachel, I would hope for this. Ad bo chalifasi. Until the time of my passing, there's that word, chalifasi, as passing. Until the days of my passing would come. Meaning, I would be, yeah, going back to what Debbie said actually before, I would say, it's okay. Yeah, my passing is coming and that's fine, I can deal with it because I have this other hope of what's going to come afterwards. Tikra, you would summon me, V'anochi e'eneka, and I would answer you, which is a phrase he used also in chapter 13, sentence 22. L'maseh yadecha tichsov, you would long for that which your hands produced. There would be no hester panim, I wouldn't hide from you the way that you hide from me. You would call, I would answer you. It would be great. If I could only believe in what Eliphaz says, that there is hope coming at the end, I'd be good. I could put up with everything. It's the absence of hope that he says, it just says to me, there's nothing to long for. All I have is this suffering until the end. And that's what he says here. Now, when he says in the beginning of this sentence 15, you would call to me and I would answer you, so the commentators differ on what that means. If you take a look at your sheet at source number 6, Ibn Ezra, Tikra v'anochi aneka, you would call and I would answer you. You would call lakacha nafshi, to take my life at the time of my passing. Ein bikoach lema'ein, I don't have the ability to refuse that. Tichsof, you would long, you would yearn. Kilu tis'aveh liros ma'aseh yodecha, as though you would long, you would desire to see your handiwork. V'hiyan neshama, meaning the soul. So what he's saying is, I would die willingly. If I knew that there was something else, wouldn't bother me. You'd call, summon me home, you want to see me? Fine. I'm good with that. That's the way that that Ibn Ezra renders it. Alternatively, take a look at source number 7 with Malbim. He says it's talking about the time of this ultimate resurrection. He says, Hagam shebechayim ha'ela ba'olam hazeh, eino rotze la'anot oti al tza'akati. Granted that in this life, in this world, God doesn't want to answer me for my cries. Shanit zoeg al shanis yasarti b'chinam, when I cry about my unjustified suffering. B'chayim ha'achirim, in this next life, she'aviu chalifas chayim ela, which will replace this one. Az tikra ata elai, then you will call to me. Utchayeni, you will give me life. V'tashiv li tova tachas yisurai, you will give me good in place of my suffering. Kilu az l'maseh yadecha tichsof, as though you will then yearn for your handiwork, you will want to be close with me. Yes, Susan.
Why has he suddenly given up on Allah Haba? I understand all his suffering, but where does the reference in his head come from? There's no Olam Haba. There's nothing in his suffering to say that there is no Olam Haba. So something must have bothered him to feel this.
So I want to go back to your question. The first words that you said. You asked, when does he or where does he give up? Who says he ever believed it? Who says he ever believed it at all? Keep in mind that we have, right, we have three possibilities for who this person Job is, right? He may be a metaphor, in which case we can impose whatever we want on him. He may be a Jew, and he may be someone who isn't Jewish. So I have no idea what set of beliefs he had in chapter 1, coming into chapter 1, versus what he's displaying now. It could be that he never believed in it. What I do think, though, is very interesting is, you know, we discuss when this book is written and when it's presented to the Jewish people as a book for them to read. And the best guesses that we had were towards the end of the First Temple through the very beginning of the Second Temple. Somewhere in there, when we had reasons to argue for the end of the First Temple, we had reasons to argue for the period in between, we had reasons to argue for the beginning of the Second. But the point is, the only way this is going to show up here is if the reader of that time does have familiarity with such an idea, such that a rejection by Job is going to be meaningful. In other words, Jews of this point in time are clearly versed in the idea that, yes, there is a resurrection. I mean, this isn't our only source. We have sources that go back biblically to life after death. And the idea of the resurrection and coming back is explicit, as I mentioned before, in the end of Daniel. We're good with that. My point is only to say, I don't know what he's thinking. I don't know what his thought process was, whether this was always true for him, or whether this was part of his transition when he suffered, and he just said, well, it can't be. I don't know. But I know that the reader is somebody who's familiar with such an idea of resurrection, and is meant, I think, to be shocked by this. I mean, what Job is doing is meant to be a surprise to the reader, who turned the page and said, wait, what's that? What is this doing in my Tanakh? Yes. That's the way I would see it. And we still have to resolve it. We're just reading right now. But take a look at the next couple of sentences, because he's going to finish his thought here. He says, Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16. When he's describing what it would be like if there were a restoration of life to the dead, he says, Ki atat se'adai tispor, then now you would count my steps, which is a phrase he's used, phrases like that before. He talked about how terrible it is that God watches his steps. He says, now you would count my steps, lo tishmor al chatasi, and you would not guard my sins. Instead of counting my steps in order to say how many times I sinned, in order to zap me, it would actually be a positive. You want to be close to me. That's why you're counting my steps, God.
He says not count KPS. Then you would not count my steps or keep watch over my...
They're taking the word low and referring it back then, which I find odd.
Which changes the whole...
Yeah, I mean...
Well, not really. It means then you wouldn't be paying so much attention to me.
Right. The problem is that I don't know how they did that with the word low. Okay. Interesting. I don't know. As I've said off and on, throughout the year, every verse that I'm quoting you, pretty much, I'm bringing you a selection of ideas, but not the range of ideas, because we would never get anywhere. So, it could be. He says, "Chasum bitzror pishi vatitpol al avoni." He says, "You would no longer." This is still part of his Lo Tishmor in sentence 16. He says, no longer would my sins be sealed up for you in a bag. Vatit pol al avoni, with you being tet pelam et tofel. Remember we saw that before? Tofle sheker? We connected to tafalnu sheker? You would not layer on the sins for me, adding to my sins. He says, you wouldn't do what you do to me now. Everything would be wonderful. I would love to see a world, God, in which you were friendly. That's what he's saying. He says, I long for it. Don't tell me that I hate God. I just wish, God were a little more friendly to me. That's what he's saying. I want hope. And he concludes with the last several sentences here saying, there's no such hope for man. Doesn't exist. Mountains have more hope than human beings do, he says. Pasuk Yuchet, sentence 18. Ve'ulam bat, har nofel yibol. Vitzur ye'etak mimekomo. He says, when a mountain falls, yibol. So yibol usually would be, a term we already used before, deterioration. It falls and it deteriorates. A boulder is shifted from its place. However, take a look at Rashi. I brought it for you in source number 8, and look at the way he reads it. He says, Har hanofel gav ho yibol v'yase afar. When a mountain falls, its height yibol. And I didn't translate it on purpose. You'll see why. Its height will yibol. Utehelo tikva. It will have hope. Lehenos mimenu, for benefit to come from it. Vitzura sherne atak mimakomo gamhu, the same thing for a boulder that is shifted from its place. Yibol lashon tivuah, produce, meaning yivul. Instead of rendering yibol as to deteriorate, he's rendering yibol like to produce. If the mountain collapses, there's dirt that things can grow from. That's the statement that he's making. It's not a loss. Mitzudat David had a I think it was Mitzudat David, had a similar idea. He says, reading Pasuk Yutet, sentence 19, Avanim, shachakumayim, stones are eroded by water. Tishtov sefichecha afar aretz, the streams will flood the dirt of the ground, generated from the stone, from the mountain, and so on. V'tikvat enosh he'evadata. But as far as human beings, the hope, and there's that word again, tikva, the hope of man, he'evadata, you have destroyed. Man does not even have the hope that the mountain has of becoming dirt and having things grow from him. The man has no hope. Now, I we could get into the whole nitrogen fixation and what happens when the body returns to the soil, but that's not his point. He says, Titkifehu lanetzach vayahaloch. Instead, titkifeyu, takif, is strong. You attack him with strength forever. Vayahaloch. And he goes away, he's gone. Mishanef fanav, vatishalacheyu, his face changes in death, you send him away. Yichbedu vanav, velo yeda. This one you could translate in a few different ways, I'm taking one way. His children are honored, and he doesn't even know it. His children may rise to some position of power, excuse me, and you won't know. Vyitzaru, velo yavin lamo, they'll be in pain. And he won't know. Ach b'saro alav yichav, v'nafsho alav te'eval. Only his flesh will pain him, and his soul will mourn for himself. And that is the way he ends his speech. Boy, oh boy. Yeah.
But he talks generally about the son of man, right? He has lost his son.
Yeah.
Why did he not speak from a personal perspective at that point?
Good question. I could offer a couple of different ideas. Sharon asks, why doesn't he speak about his own direct loss and the loss of his kids, since he invoked them here? The first answer I would give, and maybe I'm reading this inappropriately in giving this answer, but remember that Bildad said to him that his kids must have sinned. Right? If this happened, they must have done something wrong, or he seemed to imply that the kids had sinned. And I'm wondering if he wants to go there. Like, he doesn't want to open up a conversation about his kids and have someone say something that horrible to him.
Well, but he's speaking very generally.
Yes.
Right here, when son, the teen on it, well, he has lost his, and I think it is probably more likely that he would say something about that at this point.
Well, it also, the other point, which I think is more just within the text itself, is that they're not his point here. His point here is to say that even if there is some good that comes after death, even if one of the people in his, among his visitors, let's say Bildad, who said that things turn out to be good in the end. So let's say Bildad were to say to him, maybe things don't happen that are positive in a person's lifetime, but his children will gain somehow from the suffering that he had. He says, guess what? I'm not going to know. It doesn't bring me any satisfaction. That's his, I think is, and therefore mentioning his kids who didn't even outlive him isn't to the point. His point is to say, I wouldn't even be aware of it. But there's a lot to say here, and we have 10 minutes. So I'm just going to grab a couple of key points within this. First of all, when it says he won't know of the honor or pain of his children, he only knows his own. So take a look at source number 9, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, the English at the top of the next side. Mitzudat David is bothered because on the one hand, he says, one only knows of his own. On the other hand, he says, a person doesn't know what happens, and therefore he isn't aware of his kid's state. On the other hand, he said, he grieves for himself, he knows his own pain. So is he conscious, or is he not conscious? What defines what he's going to know posthumously? So Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler writes, that he doesn't know anything, according to Job. He says, "Kasher b'saro od alav az yichav midvar hamachov." He says, when the person's flesh is still on him, while he's still alive, at that point he is in pain from this cause of pain. Ukshayisa nafsho etzlo, when he's still alive, az his abla, then his soul mourns ba'avur tzar v'roa hamikra, because of the pain and the terrible things that happen. But Job is saying that no, there's no sensation, there's no awareness posthumously. Now, the Gemara in Brachos, the Talmud, which I'm going to quote more in a minute in source number 11, actually has a very interesting debate on this point in terms of what a person is aware of after death. But one of the things that they insist is that one knows about his own pain when the body deteriorates. That's one of the explanations that's given for why Jews traditionally will not use a casket that will delay the deterioration of the body. The idea that it shouldn't be delayed because he's actually experiencing it, which is a very frightening idea. But if you take a look at source number 10, you find here the Talmud picking up on when it says that the soul mourns for itself. This is the origin of another idea that people are probably familiar with, the idea that the soul of the person who passed away is present during Shiva. Right? You've heard that? So that comes from this verse. The Talmud building on this verse, source number 10. Amar Rav Chisda says, Nafsho shel adam mis'abelas alav kol Shiva. During the mourning period, during Shiva, a person's soul mourns for itself. Shenamar, they quote our verse, V'nafsho alav te'aval, his soul will be avail, will mourn for himself. Uchsiv, and they quote another verse, V'yaz le'aviv evel shivas yamim, they're quoting the verse in which we are told that Joseph has a 7-day mourning period for his father, and that shows the word avail, evel, as a period of 7 days of mourning. So much so that Rav Yehuda continues to say, I'm going to say it outside in the interest of time, but you can read it here. Rav Yehuda says that if there are no mourners, people should still go to the house where the person lived in order to sit Shiva, so to speak, for even though it's not their obligation, they should still do it for this person who passed away. And they tell a story about somebody who appears in a dream after this had been done to Rav Yehuda to say, thank you so much for what you did, that you came for the Shiva, even though there were no mourners to comfort. And Rabbi Avo said that the deceased knows everything that's said in his presence, and that's one of the reasons why we're very careful about what is said near the body. But take a look at number 11. Number 11 has the debate I mentioned before about what the body is aware of. What does a person actually know? B'nei Rabbi Chiya nafuk l'kiryasa aikr lehu talmudayu. The sons of Rabbi Chiya went out to the villages after he had passed away. They went out among the towns. They had fields they wanted to visit. And their learning became difficult for them. Havu kamitsari lad kure. They labored painfully to try to remember what they had been studying. Amarlo chad lechavre. And one said to the other, Yada avun b'hait sara. Do you think our father knows what we're going through? Amarlo idach mena yada. The other one said, why should he know? Well, vaksiv. The text says, yichbedu banav v'lo yada. The text says his sons will be honored and he will not know. So clearly, our father, Rabbi Chiya, doesn't know. So Amar Le'idach, the other one replied, V'lo yada, but he doesn't know. Look at the same text. It says, Ach b'saro alav yichav. He feels pain. V'nafsho alav te'aval. And he mourns for himself. So clearly there is an awareness. And that goes through, there's a long debate there with a story about someone who slept in a cemetery and overheard the dead speaking to each other. All sorts of really interesting pieces in this discussion there in the Talmud, talking about whether the dead are aware of what happens in this world. And what's fascinating for me is not so much the debate itself, which is a debate that we're never going to answer, because those who know the answer don't come back to tell us, but that they're taking the verses here from Job seriously. This is the speech of somebody who is very angry at God, and who's not necessarily speaking from a position of faith, but they're taking what he has to say very seriously because it is canonized by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, by the Great Assembly. They stuck this in your Tanakh. And as surely as all the other verses are meant to be Torah, this is meant to be Torah also. And so that's why they look at it and say, well, what can this teach us? So does that mean that the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, does that mean they're rejecting Tchias HaMeisim? Are they rejecting the resurrection of the dead because of the words that we're seeing in Job's mouth? So, you'll be very shocked when you hear me say no.
It's in Kohelet, too.
It's in Kohelet. Also, the simple read is, this is just Job talking. Which, again, the fact that the Talmud takes him seriously makes me wonder whether you can really give that answer. Because if it's really just Job talking, then why did the Talmud bother to wrestle with his statements? A second approach is to note, he contradicts himself. Right? As we've noted, he says the soul is not aware of what happens, then he says the soul is aware of what happens. And so, maybe, just like in Kohelet, the speaker is going through turmoil and saying one thing here and then another thing there. And that's a possibility. Or, I brought you another possibility, source number 12. Rabbi Sadia Gaon in the 10th century discusses life after death. As he explains, it is clear within Torah that there is a belief in life after death. You can go back to the Chumash and you can find it in several different places, although it's not discussed at length. What he says people are really troubled by is the question of this resurrection thing. Does that mean people coming back to this planet alive? Or does it mean something up there in an Olam Haba? And he says, no, it means coming back to this planet, walking this overpopulated earth. That's what we're talking about having happen, is everybody coming back here. And he says, he goes through a series of sections, in section 7 of his Emunot Vidayot, he says, people draw their ideas from various verses, and those who say it's not in this world, but it's somewhere up there, so to speak, they get it from certain verses, which they mistranslate. And so he says, in source number 12, he says, I investigated a third source for those who claim that there is no Triat HaMeitim. The words in brackets are my own addition. And that's from verses, biblical verses. So I look to see, is there anything in there that indicates that the dead don't come back to this world? And he says, I found cause for people's doubts that people may depend on when they say, no, this doesn't happen, that there is no resurrection in this world. And so he says, I mentioned these in order to disagree. And among them is, lo and behold, our verse from Job. Well, actually, he quotes an earlier verse from the same chapter, V'ish shachav v'lo yakum, that a man lies down and does not rise up. So he says, V'sponanti calls it heitev. I've examined all this well. V'lo matzasi achad mehem shachefetz bo shabore omer shalo yechayez hamesim. He says, I have not found any verse that says that the Creator is not going to bring the dead back to life. What it's saying is that a human being does not have it within his control to rise from the grave having died. He can't shake off the dirt and come home. He says these verses, the verses describe people pleading with their Creator, saying, have mercy on me, because once I'm gone, I can't come back on my own. And that's what he says Job is saying. He says Job is not denying belief in a resurrection. Job is saying simply that there's no hope, because I do not have it within my capacity to restore myself to life. I can't engineer my own resurrection. That's the way that he reads it. I think, regardless of how one reads it, it is very clear within our tradition that what Job is saying here can't be the last word on the subject. That it's not as though you could point to this verse in Job and say, see that? Jews don't believe in. There's too much that flies in the face of it for Job to have won with this self-contradictory couple of verses. What I want to do just is I wanted to do a very, very fast summary and then one more source. And then if people want to stick around to discuss that point, I'll be glad to. I want to make sure to get to the ending. I know people have to leave Pesach Rosh and so on. The quick summary of Job's speech is, number one, you can't convince me. Number two, everything that is happening is unjust. Number three, I want to bring God up on charges. What God has done to me is inappropriate, and as long as He won't hurt me, and as long as He won't intimidate me, I will speak to Him in a way that is honest and faithful, as opposed to what the others have done. His three claims are, I haven't sinned, I am insignificant and therefore unworthy of your attention, and I'm temporary and lowly, so why bother zapping me? And as far as those of you who have said, there's hope for me, there is no hope, there is only death, and there's nothing to hope for. If you take a look at the last source, one of the verses that we read here towards the end, chapter 14, chapter 14, sentence 19, said, Avanim shachakumayim, stones are worn away by water. So I bring you the way this is used in a midrash on the story of Rabbi Akiva. There are a couple of different versions of it that appear. I brought you one that I felt was very clear. Ma hayat chila socha Rabbi Akiva? How did Rabbi Akiva start out? We know the story that he's 40 years old when he begins to learn. How did he start out? Amru, they said, Ben Arba'im Shana Hayav Lo Shana Kulum. He was 40 years old, he had never learned. Pam Achas Haya Omeid Al Pia Be'er. Once he was standing by a well. Amar, Michakak Evanzu. And he said, Who was it who dug this? Amru Lo Hamayim, Shetadir Noflim Aleha B'chol Yom. And they told him the water falls on that every day, and that was what ate away at the stone until you had what you see in front of you. Amrulo Akiva, they said to him, Akiva, Iyata Korea Vanim Shach Kumayim, don't you know the verse from Job? The verse that says that the stone is worn away by water. And Miyad Haya Rabbi Akiva Dun Beatzma, Kav Dun Kavachor Beatzma, and Rabbi Akiva deduced from this a lesson for himself. Ma Rach. He says, if something soft like water, can it chisel away at something hard? So, divrei Torah shakashin kebarzel, alachas kama v'kama sheyachkaku es libi, how much more so the words of Torah which are as hard as iron will carve away at my heart, shubasa v'dam, which is flesh and blood. Miyad chazar lomo Torah, and then he went to study Torah. This is his inspiration. There are numerous accounts, at least two separate schools of thought as to Rabbi Akiva's origin and what brought him to Torah and his relationship with Rachel and so on. But the point stands that there's a positive message we can draw from this verse, the power of the water to carve away at the stone, and the power of the lessons that we have here to carve away at us. Thank you very much. Have a chakash v'sameach, a wonderful Zisin Pesach. We resume here, God willing, April 14th. And like I said, I'll stick around for a few minutes to talk about this Tzias HaMeisim issue, the resurrection of the dead.